Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show, monthly market update episode for this current month of July 2017. I am here again with our resident expert economist and wealth advisor, Paul Sloat, also founder of Green Drake Advisors based in Wayne, Pennsylvania. If this is your first time joining us here on the REI Diamond Show, or if you are one of our returning loyal listeners, welcome to the show. Every week, I invite a real estate expert from somewhere in the United States to share their wisdom as it relates to real estate investing. If you're interested in checking out our catalog of past shows or interested in receiving an email when the weekly episode is released, please sign up at www.reidiamonds.com. You'll also get a free download of my book on wholesaling titled Become a Wholesale Real Estate Master. In addition to our weekly expert guest format, once per month, Paul Sloat joins us here on the show and fills us in on the economic forces at work in the national and global economy and what those forces are expected to do to the local real estate investment markets in the short and long term. This month, Paul presents some additional compelling reasons why to expect single-family housing to remain strong. I know there are a lot of people sitting around waiting for another crash, but I believe it's nowhere in sight. Of course, everybody's entitled to their own opinion. Let's hear it from Paul. All right, welcome back to the show, Paul. For listeners' sake and posterity, today is the middle of July. It's July 13, 2017. Welcome back to the show, Paul.
Thanks, Dan. Glad to be back.
Absolutely. So you want to give us a rundown of what you're seeing taking place out here in the world that might concern us real estate investors and even other business owners out here?
All right. So let's talk about a couple of things. I'm going to start with, you know, one of those big boring institutions called the Federal Reserve. So what's the Federal Reserve said lately? This past week, what they have basically said is, oh, I know we told you we were going to raise rates in December, but guess what? We're probably not going to do that. So what it appears the Federal Reserve wants to do is allow the economy to run a little hotter than it has in order to ensure we have inflation and we have some wage inflation. However, when that happens, it might be time to watch out, because what they have said is now we're going to wait until we see inflation. And for those of you who don't know this, inflation is a lagging indicator to the economy. So if you were to go on your computers and look up the index of lagging indicators published by the Conference Board, inflation is one of them. So what the Fed has said is it's going to focus on a lagging indicator for the economy as opposed to a leading indicator for the economy, which means that inflation will likely get worse than they expect, and that eventually when they raise rates, they'll be more aggressive about it, because inflation is a lagging indicator. If it gets going and they need to raise rates, it's going to keep going. So that's just one little thought to keep in mind. Here's another little thought about the consumer, and then we'll talk a little bit about housing. But if we were to look at the consumer's balance sheet, their balance sheet's in pretty good shape, and household liabilities to net worth are back down to 16%. Now, the last time they were down around this level was in the mid to early 1990s. So the consumer is effectively in good shape, and we've done away with 100% of the run-up of household liabilities to net worth, which peaked somewhere around 26%. Now, we have to be a little bit careful here, because part of the reason that this has dropped back down is housing prices have exploded upwards, and in many areas of the country, they are at or above their peaks reached back in 2007. In addition, the stock market has marched straight upward, And that's also affected this ratio. So the ratio, if we were to normalize those things, is probably a little bit higher. But even with that, it is something to keep in mind as the consumer is in pretty good shape. And it also shows that the consumer has increased his or her liquidity. Latest data, household cash or deposits, as it's known in the banking system, are around 12% of their net worth, which is up significantly. And the last time we were here was somewhere in the early 1990s. That excludes the explosion during the recession where net worth collapsed. But if we were to look on a normalized basis, we're in pretty good shape here. So we expect this to continue to rise as households keep more cash or near cash around. Another thing we should think about here is household real estate to net worth. And despite the rise in prices for real estate is actually not a large piece of the consumer's balance sheet. Real estate's somewhere between 25 and 30% of the consumer's balance sheet net worth. And it used to be at the peak in 07 around 40%, 39.2% to be precise at the peak. But the normalized level, which I will talk about, normalized, meaning we're talking about the 80s and most of the 90s, is usually in the low 30s. So it's unclear to us whether that's going to get there because the stock market declines or whether the stock market goes sideways and housing continues upward. But it appears to us that however we look at it, the consumer's balance sheet's in good shape. The next thing I would like to mention is that if we were to look at the deposit to liability ratio, it's in pretty good shape and back to the 1990s, early 1990s level. And then if we were to look at some other things like the job market and all, that seems okay as it always does late in the cycle. But what we think is more important, especially for the housing market, is this mortgage foreclosure roll-off. For those of you who remember, we had about 8.7 million households foreclosed from the end of 2007 to the end of 2011. And where are we today? We are in 2017. And why is this important? It's important because after 7 years, a major default rolls off a consumer's credit report, and they are able to then get a loan with government backing. And since almost all mortgages are through some form of Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac or another government agency backing, it means that these 8.7 million households are about to be able to buy a house again. And that represents a lot of people, especially if we were to add them to the millennials. The millennials are, as we know, the largest generation in the country and the biggest piece of the population at 23% of the overall population. And when we look at the price to rent relative to the historical ratio, and by that I mean the price to pay for the average mortgage payment versus what you would pay for rent, today we're at 1.34. Throughout the 90s, this ratio ran around 2. So interest rates could go up significantly and we would just be getting back to the place where we were in the past. So from our perspective, that means you could have inflation, you could have higher interest rates, and the housing market should be okay. The other interesting fact, which we know, is that while both single family starts and multifamily starts have ramped up to together through the end of 2015. Then we started to see a divergence, and this divergence is correct, as we have commented. We're building before. We're building too many multifamily units and not enough single-family units. And the single-family units from 2015 to today have marched up in an irregular line, while the multifamily starts have stalled out or begun to roll over. As the market realizes that returns are not going to be what they were on multifamily housing. Multifamily housing also has the issue that when we look historically, the ratio of rent to income is at the historical high end of the ratios, and it will probably regress to the median. So you have a problem in the multifamily, but single family start have a long way to go. Single family starts were 781,000 in 2016 and are estimated to be up 10% this year to somewhere around 860,000 to 870,000. As we have long commented, we need approximately 1.1 to 1.2 million housing starts plus. We need another 300,000 multifamily starts. That brings us to about 1.5 million housing starts in total. So if we were to look at where we are, there will be several years at least of growth in single-family housing starts, even at a moderate growth rate of, let's say, 8 to 10% a year to get us back to the long-term average. And it is likely that we will have an overshoot because what will happen is the millennials are aging into what I would call their prime home buying years. And as we've said before, we need to supply them with houses. And we just don't have enough inventory to handle the volume that of demand that we will see. And this, given that demand is increasing and that we have out there insufficient supply growth to meet the demand, it will probably underpin sustained home price appreciation. So even though prices have been going up, they will likely continue to go up because we are sitting here watching an imbalance between supply and demand, which is exactly the opposite of what was going on in 2005 to 2007. On the other hand, we're going to see this oversupply continuing in the apartment market and likely getting worse after the next recession. A couple of other little things we can think about here is one of the reasons the market is so tight is that the new home price premium compared to the average home is currently at about 32%. So if I'm buying a home for the first time, I would probably try to buy an existing home because I don't have to pay a 32% premium for a new home. By the way, the long-term average is only somewhere in that 10 to 15% range, somewhere around 13, 14%. And if we think about it in those terms, then we have a long ways to go for those two areas to close. And they can close by new home prices either going up significantly or new home prices stalling while existing home prices play catch up over time. You'll probably get a little bit of both as we look forward. The other thing we should look at here is the mortgage payment percent of median household income when we look at a 30-year mortgage. I'll talk about 30-year mortgages in a minute, but let's just use this number. For comparison, today the ratio stands at approximately 15%, and prior to the housing bubble and for the last 20 years, it's averaged around 20%. So if we were to look at that on a long-term historical basis, it could rise and have little impact on housing turnover and housing demand. And as we've said before, we expect demand to remain strong because of the demographics. And in fact, interest rates could go up by 200 basis points from today and still have little impact on housing demand. Maybe a little short-term blip, but not a huge impact. So when we look at housing, we continue to be positive on housing. One thing we will mention for those of you who are in the business of flipping homes, that it has become much tougher and more difficult to flip homes as we have seen things become tighter in buying housing, so the margins have become slimmer. And to flip, that is. So you really need to know what you're doing. And that's what we see going on in the housing area. And what we should also keep in mind is that there are some other facts that we're going to talk about. We've talked about them before, but I'm going to give you a quick overview of retail because it's something we should think about as potentially being available, a lot of retail space to be repurposed into other types of real estate. The United States is seeing a significant transformation of real estate channels into online, as everyone knows. And it's beginning to really have an impact on the physical real estate demand and the number of transactions run through physical real estate. And so what we can expect over the longer term is that we're just going to have less physical real estate devoted to retail in the United States. There is a big reason for that. Mostly we have 3 to 4 times as much real estate per capita as in most other major developed economies. Well, if we've already got too much real estate and all of a sudden we're going to take some of the demand away from that real estate and hand it over to something called Amazon or maybe some of the online channels for some of the traditional retail stores, we're going to have less demand for that real estate when that real estate is already too much. So we expect a bunch of this real estate to, over time, get turned over and turned into other things. So, for example, we have seen a number of malls converted to various things like condos and co-ops and townhouses and other things that can make good use of the fundamental real estate. Speaking of real estate, let's talk a little about what we see going on in the office and hotel areas. As we've commented, we've been building too many hotel rooms, and we've expected that this would eventually begin to have an impact on occupancy and average daily rate, and it's beginning to have an impact on occupancy growth and occupancy as a percent of existing hotels, and it's beginning to have an impact on the margin on average daily rates. So combined, it's beginning to have an impact on the hotel industry. This can be seen in that while the amount of growth in hotel construction was significant last year, it has slowed tremendously this year, and by slowed tremendously, I mean we've slowed from over 20% growth in 2016 in hotel lodging construction to under 5% in hotel lodging construction growth this year. And we would expect that that would peak probably sometime in the next year or so as the economics start to deteriorate, just as we're already seeing them deteriorating in the apartment area. The other area where we're seeing significant growth in supply is office. Office construction was up somewhere in the high teens last year and is expected to be up only about 10% this year as we're starting to bring on more space than can be absorbed. So that might be an issue for rents over the next few years as leases come up with your existing tenants or as leases need to be filled for empty space. So as we look at numerous areas of real estate, what we're seeing now is supply coming to meet demand. And without a significantly faster growing economy, it would be hard to absorb all the space. The only area where we're seeing and where we think we're going to continue to have a shortage of space is in the single family market, where we are starting to see prices continue to go up. And we will mention there is one other area of real estate which has started to have an impact where the rents have stopped going up, and that is self-storage. As we've mentioned in the past, self-storage real estate, it has under construction a record amount of square footage, and surprise, surprise, rents are up 0% year over year. And the people building all the real estate, including some of the major public companies, are surprised. Well, I don't think any of us are surprised because it's simple supply and demand. And that is my update for today. Dan, any questions?
Here is the question. The question is, there is already some slight increases in the interest rate already over the last 18 months or so, correct?
Correct.
And so, like, I'm looking at a mortgage I did a refinance on. I'm closing tomorrow afternoon, and I'm paying 5.375. I expect that's probably slightly higher than I could have gotten 2 years ago. Is that, you know, increase from the Fed an attempt to sort of temper just a bit some of what's going on? And maybe they're looking at that and feeling like that was, you know, enough action to kind of maybe stop this thing from going like too fast down the highway with no brakes. And yet now they still reserve some of the rate rises for, you know, later down the line to kind of slow up the home prices and things of that nature. If that becomes an issue again, maybe 6 months or 9 months from now.
I think it is more that the market felt that they were moving too quickly in raising rates. And it would have a major impact on the economy because the yield curve was flattening. And the Fed took that as a warning sign that they were moving too quickly with their interest rate increases, especially in a low inflation environment. Now, you have to remember that from an inflation perspective, what is one of the critical pieces of inflation, right? It's oil prices, right? Oil flows into everything, whether it's chemicals that go into plastic that goes into everything, or whether it is something like the energy to fuel the diesel truck. So, what's the price of crude done over the last year? Nothing, more or less. Right? And in fact, it came back down somewhat. Now, let's think about what's going to happen going forward. We've got a couple of things coming that people should not ignore. Okay. Number one, investment has collapsed outside of OPEC and the U.S. oil patch. As a result, production is declining over 6% per annum for what is approximately 43 to 44% of global production. Yes, the U.S. is growing, and yes, OPEC is growing, and we have had to accommodate Libya and Nigeria coming back on. But once they are accommodated, there's not that much growth because Nigeria has been in a long-term downtrend in its production, and Libya has been up and down because of the civil war that's gone on. But maybe I think in Libya people have cut a deal because the money is worth more than fighting, especially when we're talking about 1 million barrels a day of oil. That seems to me at $45 a barrel, at $45 million a day in revenue, I think we can find a way to split this among the warring factions. So the other salient point here is that Saudi Arabia plans to bring Saudi Aramco public. Why are they taking Saudi Aramco public? They're taking Saudi Aramco public, which is the crown jewel of the country, because they are bleeding cash. And by bleeding cash, I mean lots of cash is going out the door for the country and the government and not coming back in. And why is that? Because the overall government spend is above the revenues they can bring in at today's price of oil. So what is Saudi Arabia doing? One, it's been jawboning over the oil price, but two, they just announced that they're going to deliver 600,000 barrels less outside of the country because demand in the country has increased significantly. Now, yes, Saudi demand has been growing at a fairly decent clip. However, it didn't magically grow 600,000 barrels a day. So what's going on here? Saudi is accommodating the extra growth from Libya and Nigeria to make sure the market stays balanced. And next year, when they don't have extra to bring back onto the market, well, guess what? The Saudis can start pumping that 600,000 barrels again. And here's the other thing that's going on. They really would like the price of oil to go up so they can take Saudi Aramco public at a better price. So when I kind of look at what's going on, the oil market to some extent is a manipulated market, as manipulated for reasons that have nothing to do with the economics. Economics do have an impact, and what the policy is in the Middle East. So what we're going to see here is that Saudi, I believe, wants the price up because it wants to bleed less cash and it wants a better price when it sells a piece of Saudi Aramco. Does that answer the question?
So what will that impact in line with the interest rates that we would have to worry about?
Well, what will happen is inflation will accelerate and interest rates should drift upward.
As the price of oil also begins to drift upward from the Saudi actions, right?
Correct. Because what we've been having, which is very similar to what happened in the late 1990s, for those of us who remember, we've had over the last couple of years what I would call a deflationary expansion. In other words, the prices of goods were going down, but the economy was growing, which has happened in the past. And the other thing you have to remember that's kept inflation down is the U.S. dollar. As we have commented often in our monthly letters, the U.S. dollar had a huge move where the rest of the world drove the dollar up approximately 35%, if not more, depending on the currency. And we need to undo that. And that has started to happen under Mr. Trump. And I think it will continue. And that's the other factor that's held back inflation is the dollar went up and the cost of competing goods from other countries went down. So it held down inflation of goods manufactured in this country. Well, if the dollar drops a bit, the price of all those goods can start going up a bit more and a bit faster. And the price of goods from other countries will have to go up because if they don't, the U.S. government might say something to those governments, especially when trade has become a hot-button issue. So we think inflation will definitely heat up next year, given the background in commodities, given the background in the dollar. And that will lead to higher interest rates on the long end and for borrowing, and ultimately the Fed will respond.
So, Paul, I was a little bit of a neophyte during the 2005, 6, 7, and 8 era. I'm sure you probably have better recollection of that. Would you say that my guess at maybe what the Fed did during that time is what they're not trying to repeat right now? I feel like the interest rates were rising at a much quicker clip during that period. And then we had the Bear Stearns collapse come, which really drove the nail into the coffin, but these were rising before that. Was that a correct observation of mine, or
yes,
is that just
what the Fed is doing is they're repeating sort of what they did in the 1960s right now, They're raising rates very gradually, but I do think there will be a point where they will accelerate those rate rises. But right now, they're raising rates very gradually when they probably should be raising them more aggressively. Remember, I said inflation is a lagging indicator, and they're not trying to repeat the mistake of the last recession. And historically, what happened is the yield curve actually inverted in 2006. For those of us who remember, and in fact, it inverted approximately 18 months before the recession started, which we date from October 2007, not December 2007, when the government says it started. So what the Fed is trying to do is not invert the curve too soon, but eventually, if inflation pressures become too much, they will become more aggressive on rate rises. The other thing going on at the Fed, remember, is that Janet Yellen is done as of January 31, 2018. Mr. Trump has said he plans to appoint Mr. Gary Cohn as the new head of the Fed. Now, whether Mr. Cohn ends up becoming the head of the Fed is unclear, as Larry Summers was the last, you know, presidential candidate, and that candidate failed ultimately to become chairman of the Federal Reserve. So we'll see. But the other thing the Federal Reserve tries to do for the incoming chairperson is to provide that person flexibility. Thus, the person has room to raise rates if necessary, or they can act to lower rates. So the Fed tries to set that person up for success when they come in to give them credibility, and that's what's going on. That is why they moved the unwinding of QE up to September as opposed to December. They wanted to make sure it was clearly underway before the new chairperson came in. So that's why QE is starting to be unwound in September, 3 months earlier than original plan. And therefore, the new Fed chairperson will just be continuing the policies that have already been put in place. Does this make sense, Dan?
It does. I have two stupid questions for you real quick. One,
they're not stupid questions. Go ahead.
Define QE for me in simple terms, and the other one would be to define briefly the yield curve.
Okay, so QE stands for quantitative easing. Quantitative easing is the policy that the Federal Reserve put in place to prevent in 2008 and 2009 the economy having a depression similar to the 1930s. If the government hadn't bailed out the banks and the Fed hadn't injected massive amounts of money into the economy, you probably would have ended up in a 1930s-like depression because of the collapse of the financial system. So what the Fed did is they put a lot of money in, and it wasn't enough to really get the economy going. So they kept throwing money in under a program called quantitative easing, where they bought more and more bonds and provided more and more cash. And so this went on for a long time, and eventually they ended doing this because they felt the economy didn't need to be on life support. So now we've had a couple of years where they haven't been doing QE, but they haven't unwound it by taking some of the massive amount of money that they added to the economy. Now, they added over 20% of GDP of money to the economy. That's a lot of money. So when we look at this whole thing, we have a massive amount of money that's been put into the system. If, as normally occurs, when economic growth picks up, credit growth, you get a little inflation, which leads to higher velocity in money, which becomes self-reinforcing to inflation. So what the Fed is trying to do by removing some of the excess money is to prevent inflation from exploding upward. How well they do this and how finesse they can be to make sure that they don't do a little too much or a little too little, that's going to be what I call the magician's trick. Because I think it's going to be really hard to get it just right.
And they were buying bonds that were providing liquidity. So the mortgages are being, you know, made to homeowners, packaged and sold in the form of these bonds, which, to my understanding, were part of the quantitative easing program, right?
Yeah, they were one of the securities the Federal Reserve bought. The Federal Reserve bought a lot of Treasury securities, and then it went out and bought a lot of mortgage-backed securities. And it is estimated that because of quantitative easing globally, remember, it's not just the U.S. Federal Reserve, it's the Japanese Central Bank, it's the European Central Bank, it's the U.K. Central Bank, all the major Western economy central banks entered into quantitative easing. It's estimated that this kept long-term interest rates 75 to 100 basis points, or 0.75% to 1% lower than they otherwise would be. If we were to unwind QE, it appears that long rates ultimately would drift upward.
Is some of that upward drift in unwinding, that unwinding means somebody else has to buy all these bonds, so these other buyers are going to look for a little bit better spread on their money, a little higher interest rate and return on their money to buy this stuff off the balance sheet of the quantitative easing that took place, right?
Correct. And I think the issue they're going to start to face is the one that is the following. When you look sort of outside of 2 years, there's not a big premium to extend out on the yield curve, so there's no incentive. So I can buy a 2-year bond in the marketplace, and it provides almost as much yield as a 5-year bond or a 10-year bond. And so there's no reason for me to stretch out my maturity. So I think as the Fed unwinds this, there's going to be a steepening of that back end, because you're going to need to incentivize the market to buy those bonds, especially given that governments in the U.S. and Europe have significant national debt relative to GDP. And governments, when they have too much debt, as all these governments do today, traditionally gets rid of the problem through inflation. They inflate away the value of the debt. And who wants to own a very long-term instrument if the value in real terms is going to go down over a long period of time? So I think as the Federal Reserve unwinds QE, you're going to end up seeing the long end gradually increase over time.
And so the yield curve then would be, you know, let's just for simple sake.
The yield curve is, if we looked at the yield, basically at the various maturities, so at 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 30 years, those are traditional valuations. Sometimes we look at 20 years as well. It creates a curve, right? And when people talk about the steepness of the yield curve, they're looking at the difference between oftentimes the 3-month bill and the 30-year treasury note, or maybe the 1 year and the 10 year, or the 1 year and the 20 year or 30 year, however you want to, or sometimes the 2 year and the 10 year. It depends. But they're looking at the shape of that all these different maturities form based on what the different securities yield, and then what the differences are between those various maturities in terms of yield. And you can actually search yield curve on the internet, and you can come up and you can get a nice picture of the yield curve. And in fact, if you search it, you can go to treasury.gov and you'll get the daily treasury yield curve rates from the treasury, and they'll give you the official interest rates by maturity, and you can look at it, or you can go to something like stockcharts.com and see a dynamic yield curve. So it's pretty simple, and all this is publicly available on the internet today.
All right. Well, I appreciate it. I know we kind of went off into a little bit of an
conversation there. We went off into a tangent here, Dan, but that's okay.
It really helps to understand the big picture, and I appreciate, once again, Paul, you're putting together this concise information. It's kind of reinforcing again that we're looking at least in the single family residential space and in the right areas of the markets, we're still in a pretty solid position overall. So, Paul, did you want to share some contact information for listeners who might want to reach out and just tell everybody what it is that you do?
Yes, that works well. So if the listeners want to reach out to me, the best way to do that is to either go to our website at www.greendrakeadvisors.com, or you can search Green Drake on the web and we should come up as one of the first entries on that. Or you can call our offices at 610-687-7766.
All right. Thanks again, Paul, for coming on the show. Really appreciate you taking your time out today to impart this wisdom. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome, Dan, and I'm happy to be on the show.
Thank you for listening to this monthly market update episode of the REI Diamond Show. Are you interested in receiving an email notification the next time an REI Diamond Show episode is released? You can sign up at www.reidiamonds.com or subscribe through one of the podcast apps, including iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. If you have deals for sale, go to www.reidiamonds.com and send them over. I am currently buying property in Philadelphia, New Jersey, Delaware, Maryland, Chicago, Atlanta, and the Tampa Bay region in Florida. You can also find deals I have for sale along with our full catalog of REI Diamonds episodes. Basically, tons of cash generating opportunity can be found at that site. Thanks again for being a loyal listener of the show. Dan Breslin here. I'll catch you on the next episode.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.